Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, celebrating the new year with fresh catches and tastings during the Seafood Frenzy on December 31st. The event includes samples and demonstrations of fresh seafood favorites, available at all Harmon's locations.
Over the course of 4 years, the actor and director Brendan O'Hay would interview his good friend Judi Dench about all the Shakespeare parts she's played over the years. The idea, at least at first, was to transcribe the interviews and find a place for them in the archive department at Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London. But O'Hay says the interviews weren't really instructional or didactic. They were conversations between old friends, both going through a rough patch during the pandemic.
So during lockdown, I was in quite a bad place. My father was dying and my partner wasn't particularly well. And Jude is also very depressed because she's not very good at being by herself. And so in order to rescue each other, we decided to meet up and talk about Shakespeare. Now, unfortunately, there were a lot of swear words. There was a lot of talk of, dare I say it, ex-lovers. And I thought, I cannot give these tapes over to the Globe. So I just started to transcribe what we had. And then it was just by chance that I found out from an agent that several publishers have been asking for a book on Shakespeare by Judi Dench for quite a few years. And that's how this came into being.
Okay, we are recording, so no swearing.
Well, look at it, it's right down here.
What? I just need to set it up.
I don't want it so near me, I can't bear it.
But I...
Oh, God.
Okay, we're all right.
Like somebody looking at you too close.
Well, I'm now next to you. There we are.
That's no help.
Judy, can you hear me?
The first play I thought I would interview her about, because it's a play that she absolutely adores, was Twelfth Night and her playing Viola. Malvolio, who... has that famous scene where he's... And we found we got to the end about 3 hours later, and we were both fired up about it because she's not an intellectual, neither am I. She doesn't like talking about craft.
That's not my bag. I don't like analysing it. I like just doing it and saying it and seeing if it...
But I forced her to talk about craft, and we found that we had a wonderful, interesting conversation by the end of it. So I thought, well, this is a good start.
Shakespeare covered... He covers every single emotion, everything you can possibly imagine can happen to anybody in life. Mm. And he covers them in the plays.
So there was one time where Jude and I were chatting about Shakespeare and I was recording our conversation, I can't remember the play, and her grandson Sammy was out in the hallway in front of the fire with his friend Alex Boosie. And Jude and I must have been talking for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And at the end of it, this lad came in, Sammy's friend, and said, sorry, don't mind me asking, but what is it that you're talking about? Because you seem so kind of animated, the pair of you, and all I hear is passion and arguing and a lot of laughter. And I'm just intrigued to know what's making you so enthusiastic. And we just let him in on that and said, well, we're just happen to be talking about Shakespeare in these plays. And he said, oh, God, I'd love to listen in on that. And that is what then made me think, actually, maybe this has an appeal beyond Shakespeare's Globe and could possibly have a wider readership. So Jude was insistent that if we were going to have these conversations, she didn't want it to be a kind of pointy finger how-to book on Shakespeare.
He wasn't a grand person who didn't feel like all of us. He was a real man and phenomenal because he... seems to understand what all our emotions, every kind,
as
anger,
said,
jealousy,
yeah.
love, all those things.
So it just evolved into an offer on what performing Shakespeare can give people. Because Shakespeare is an international language. I profoundly believe that. I mean, as Jude says, you know, you don't just read Shakespeare just for the stories. He has the capacity to make us feel less alone. If you want to understand about grief or jealousy or love or ambition, it's all in there. It's all in those plays. And if people don't agree with what we say or they're provoked by what they say, it's for them to go off and then have their own relationships with the play. So it's not a didactic, one-size-fits-all approach to Shakespeare. It can't be. It is infinite.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, Brendan O'Hay is with us talking about his book with Judi Dench. It's called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. Part of it is just Dench doing a running commentary on the roles she's acted as O'Hay works through the plot. But there are sections called Fireside Ramblings and Critics and Audience. And if you act, you are going to love the book. It's packed with lessons like whatever you do, don't play the ending and be specific and acting is learning how to edit. And all of these insights came through even though Judi was adamant she didn't want to come off as an academic.
I mean, dare I say it, she's not very good at Jude. She's not very good at talking about herself in public and she's not very good talking about her craft. And I don't think it's because she doesn't know how to, or maybe she may argue that. She keeps on saying that she just goes on instinct. But the teacher in me and the director in me kept thinking, I had kind of my younger self thinking, well, what questions would I want to ask her? So I suppose if I had a role, it would be that. It was somebody who was perhaps new to Shakespeare. So I was going in on that level. I think because she wasn't the focus and it was the characters, and through focusing on the characters and talking about the characters, she revealed a lot about herself. For instance, you know, when we talked about Winter's Tale and Leontes, she talks about the jealousy she's experienced in her life. I mean, not with career wise, but with kind of ex-partners and with the competition there. She was very open about that. And I've not heard her speak like that before. There's something about going through, talking about these characters that kind of, she was then kind of pulling out stories about her own life and kind of memories about her own life, which kind of triggered, you know, these wonderful kind of slip roads of thought that she kind of went on. But it'd probably be a kind of a teacher stroke director and questions I would want to ask her as a student. So that was, I suppose that was my role, Doug, yeah.
She doesn't suffer fools.
She does not suffer fools. I've never told this story publicly, but, oh God, I don't know how this is going to go down. Michael, her husband, died in 2001, and she's been seeing this other chap called David Mills, who's runs the British Wildlife Centre. And about, I think, 13, 14 years ago, when she met him, she said to myself, my partner, Stephen, she said, I'd love you to come down to the house, and I'd love, because I want to start introducing David to my friends, and she said, but she said to me, she said, just try not to be yourself. I said, what? What are you trying to do? She didn't know exactly what I mean. She said, you can just be mischievous. You get that glint in your eye, that little kind of demonic glint, and you'll want to come. He's not part of the theatre, and it's early days, and I don't want you to say anything, you know, inappropriate. Anyway, Stephen and I went down. We had a very nice meal with Jude and our partner David. And in Jude's kitchen, she's got all these ceramic jugs on the ceiling. And we had a very nice meal. And at the end of the meal, I turned to David and said, so, David, what do you think of Jude's jugs? And forgive me, but I did a quick look at her breast. And David went, he was quite embarrassed. And without looking at her, she was like the colour of a kind of wonderful kind of red space hopper. She was enraged at my... and I said, because I quite like the terracotta jug up there, and I like that. So, because jugs, I don't know, is it the same in America where jugs is another name for breasts? Is this translating correctly? Or
it's completely translating.
Oh my God!
Yes.
Now I'm feeling worse having said it. and of course that night, I went to bed and I laughed myself to sleep thinking there cannot be a funnier person in the world than me. I thought, what a brilliantly witty thing to say. I woke up in the morning, she had saddlebags under her eyes. And I said, you all right? Am I all right? She said, you did so well. You did so well. And then you, forgive me, but f***ed up at the last hurdle. So she was livid. She didn't talk to me for about a fortnight. So I think we, and that may or hopefully comes across in the book. I mean, we know how to press each other's buttons. So we, in that respect, certainly not career wise, but in that respect, we're very evenly matched as friends because we are prepared to say the unsayable to each other. She says, "No one speaks to me like you do," but I think it's, well, maybe that's what a good friend, you know, should be about. But we do share lots of secrets, and we are able to kind of wind each other up very, very easily.
Well, and she loves to muck about a lot, you say. And this is, at some point in the conversation, you ask her where her love of play came from.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you about that. It comes from her family.
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the States at the moment, but, you know, certainly over here in the UK, I mean, of course, kids are always on their phones, well, as adults, but, you know, they don't go out and play. They don't climb trees. They don't fall over. They don't ride bikes. Everybody is, you know, there's an extraordinary book by, is it Jonathan Haidt, the American psychologist, The Coddling of the American Mind, you know, about what... our youngsters have stopped taking risks now, and now we're so afraid of people failing. And you see that in the rehearsal room, kind of actors and especially students, they don't want to fail anymore. They want to get it right. And, you know, how does a baby learn balance unless it falls over? You've got to make mistakes, because it's through making mistakes that's where one discovers the gold, you know. It's by falling over and falling flat on your face that is where the magic is. But her feeling of play is, I mean, that obviously comes from her childhood and her parents and the music and the swimming and the bicycle rides and the playing and the drawing, the surrounded by art. And she said,
she was encouraged to paint on the walls.
Oh, that didn't, I could, that is really shocking, isn't it? I mean, I thought you found that. Yeah, she was encouraged to paint on the wall. I mean, it sounded like an extraordinary kind of, extraordinary bucolic. Well, she says it was a swallows and Amazon's childhood. My God, wasn't it just? But she's retained that all her life. I mean, she is, as I think we say in the book, she's 89 and about to be 90 this year. But a grandchild calls her the most childish person that he knows. and she really is. She really is. And I think that's why she loves Billy Connolly so much, because she... that wonderful Billy Connolly quote, which is Billy Connolly once said, "Never trust a man who can sit alone in a room with a tea cosy and not try it on." I mean, and that was Jude. You know, if there's a wig around or something to put on a head or a box, she will do it, you know, and we have that in common. And even now, I mean, she's her sense of play and silliness. And she told me something else the other day, which was when she was very, very young, I think she can still do it, actually. She's very good at doing a seagull sound without moving her lips. I can't even attempt it. But she does it brilliantly. And when she was very young, she used to do that in the car to make her dad stop the car to think there was something wrong with the suspension of the car. And he would stop. He would pull the car apart, pull over, you know, look at the tires and all that. But, you know, she's always playing tricks on people. She's a mischief maker. She really is. But that's what's gorgeous about her, that kind of playful quality. There's a glint. There's a little kind of elfin demon lurking in there.
Let's talk about Hamlet. Ophelia was her first professional role as an actor. And this is, we need to talk about her memory too. I mean, she told you that she remembers the first day of rehearsal. She talks about being petrified. She remembers where she was standing. She remembers what she was wearing on that first day of rehearsal. Say something about her memory, which is, it just seems incredible.
It is, I mean, like with all our memories, I suppose the recent memories aren't as clear as that. But, you know, when she said that in 1957, she could remember where exactly she was standing in the rehearsal room, exactly what she was wearing. I mean, that completely blew me away. But as we were progressing through the book, she would suddenly kind of, I think there was a bit in Richard II, where suddenly she was quoting the Gardner speech, which wasn't a part she played in Richard II. She did two performances when she was about 14, I think, playing the Queen in Richard II, and then she did it professionally for about 6 months. But suddenly these kind of speeches, these Shakespeare speeches came out of her that completely blew me away. I mean, the rhythm of Shakespeare just kind of, you know, it goes deep with her. It really does, the music of it. And certainly something like The Dream or Twelfth Night, you know, we play a game, not with each other, because she knows those plays much better than I do. But I'll quote a line from either of those plays, and then she will carry on and do the whole scene and play all the parts. Wow. I mean, she is extraordinary. But you're absolutely right. The detail of the costumes, and whether it was mother of pearl buttons and it was a powder blue this and a teal, it's phenomenal, the memory. It really is. And of course, the thing is that, you know, I thought, my God, that was you asked me what my role was and I said, you're a teacher and a director and all of that, and just to think of a younger student or my younger self learning about Shakespeare. But also, she's been at the kind of vanguard of British theatre since 1957. So we're talking about almost 70 years. And of course, you know, most people now know about her film career. But isn't that worth documenting? You know, the extraordinary kind of span of being at the kind of top of a game for that length of time. And she was there. She was at the and continues to be at the forefront of all of that.
Mm. You know, she mentions to you that she thinks she has a photographic memory, and that she said now that her eyesight is going, which is sad, it's affected the way she learns lines. And it was interesting to hear that, because it seems like the process of, you know, learning and at least memorizing was almost a physical process for her in some way.
Yes, I think that's right. I think she says she has a photographic memory, and she has to see the patterns on the page. She struggles now, and it's no secret she has what's called macular degenerative disease. And it is steadily getting worse, and she can see less and less. She's very good at bananagrams. She'll do Wordle, which she's passionate about, and Bardle, which is the Shakespearean version of Wordle, which she also loves. But the eyesight is really pretty bad now, and yet she's still able to draw and paint and sketch, and which I find extraordinary. But I think you're absolutely right. That has a dramatic effect on her ability to learn. So the last few films she's done, I think Belfast certainly, and probably a little bit before that, she's had to have somebody who would read the lines to her, and she's learnt it kind of parrot fashion. But that's no compensation for being able to see the patterning on the page.
Well, while you're on the subject of her sketches, this would be a nice moment to say we see her sketches. We see her doodles in the book that you extracted from some of her scripts. She makes these little doodles, little sketches throughout her scripts. Is it part of her process? How do you understand that?
That's right. I think she just – what's interesting, I mean, I've not seen too many of her scripts, because a lot of them she just threw away. But there's a few, certainly Cymbeline and Coriolanus were there. And these wonderful, extraordinary kind of drawings in the margins. Very few notes about – you know, what the character would be about. I think she says in the book, doesn't she, whether she says she doesn't like to commit those thoughts to paper because it closes down the possibilities. But there's certainly these drawings and these doodles, and not always of her character or of other characters. And it's just, it just gives her, I suppose, time to think. So a lot of those have made them in the book. And a few of them are things she did much more recently as well. It's just another one of her talents. And she really didn't want to put those in. And that really was a fight. And I said, well, you know, if people are unfamiliar with Shakespeare, a bit nervous about Shakespeare, I think just opening the book and seeing a drawing and a rough sketch or something, it just takes the curse off it. Something she said to me the other day that was, maybe she'll kill me for saying this, but she got the most exquisite garden. And I said, oh, the bluebells are out, Jude. And she said, oh, well, now I'm going to have a cup of tea. I said, well, just come out and see the bluebells. And I said, the smell is lovely. And they're like the bluest blue I've ever seen. And she said, I can't see the colour blue at the moment. That really upset me. Because I thought, okay. But obviously she's got the memory of blue. But I wanted her to smell. It was the most glorious carpet of bluebells. And I just wanted her to experience it. But it wasn't to be on that occasion. Maybe that colour will come back.
You say that she is almost impossible to pin down when it comes to talking about herself, when it comes to talking about her process. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. But first of all, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't think it's a superstition. And I don't think I mean, she said herself that, you know, she's not an intellectual and neither am I. She does work purely on instinct. But because I kept on provoking, well, what does Shakespeare mean there? Why is that character saying it? An auto option. Because he does. And that, I said, that's no, if we're going to put this into a book, Jude, I said it'll be a very short book. Why does Viola say that? Because she does. End of. You know, we'll have about 4 pages. And I said, it's ridiculous. So I would really kind of push her. Maybe she doesn't want to kind of analyze it or didn't feel as if she wants to analyze it. But after a few sessions, she said, actually, I'm quite enjoying this. And it did kind of open up lots of discussions. But something she does say, isn't it? She says in the book, she says, because Michael used to say, when do you learn this, her husband? When do you learn the script, Jude? When do you crack it open? Because he was always poring over the scripts and writing copious notes, looking at it. And she just says, well, I like to go away and not think about it in order to think about it. She's very, very good at allowing the subconscious. And I think she said it's a bit like a kind of keeping the lid on something to allow it to kind of all the flavors to kind of come to the surface and to kind of percolate. And it's like opening a kind of a souffle. You know, the moment you open that oven door or you have a peek too early, the kind of thing collapses. So, yeah, I think she's just somebody who just trusts her subconscious to kind of to cook it in the background. I suppose in computer terms, it's buffering, isn't it? Do we used to say buffering? But
right. Well, she calls it homework, and she's really private about homework. It's as soon as the question of homework comes up, she doesn't want to talk about it. It's something she's worked out privately, it seems. And there's this other moment in that section about Hamlet that I thought was really interesting, and it says something about her regard for audiences.
Yeah.
You were asking her about whether or not at the Old Vic that whether you did a read through of Hamlet or any of the plays, and she said she didn't remember if they did, you know, that you sort of just did your blocking and you got through. You didn't overanalyze it, is what she was saying. And she said, I'll just read from the book. She says, we certainly didn't sit around and intellectualize it all. Unless the audience are going to have a share of that, I think that's just an indulgence.
Yeah.
So that's so interesting. Her regard for the audience needs to be involved in that process. You can't exclude them almost, because she talks with this kind of reverence about audience.
Well, I don't know whether it, maybe reverence is the right word, actually. I was about to dismiss that, but I think it is certainly a respect for an audience. I mean, I think we're in danger these days of losing sight of the audience. It's too much about, I mean, not always, because I try to avoid casting these actors. And certainly you see it occasionally with students, but not often. But I think there's a danger of people forget that we're in the service industry. We're there to serve the author. We're there to serve, the most importantly, the audience. And my role as a director is to empower the actor to be a conduit between the author and the audience. And that's the beginning, the end of my job as a director. I don't need to make it about me or the production about me, because that's denying the audience something. And I think that's what we have very strong opinions, Jude and I both, on that, you know, all too often you can sit around and you can over-intellectualize and you think, no, you've got to get it on its feet. You've got to tell the story. And those, you know, I've worked together with her, well, three times in the theatre and once or twice on film in a few minor parts. And she's just, you know, it's all about, what's the story? She just doesn't want cleverness. I think that's why people love her so much. She almost kind of peels that away. You're allowed to dare, this sounds incredibly pretentious. When I hear her speak Shakespeare, I feel as if I meet Shakespeare himself. I just feel there's a connection to that guy and his heart. There's just, she becomes invisible. She just becomes like a medium between me. That sounds incredibly pretentious, but she doesn't stand in the way of it. I love that about her, that it's always about the service of the story and the service of the audience. They have paid a lot of money for this. The first thing we do is at least show them respect by allowing these extraordinary words to be heard.
That's Brendan O'Hay. He's an actor and director. He and Dame Judi Dench are the authors of Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, celebrating the new year with fresh catches and tastings during the Seafood Frenzy on December 31st. The event includes samples and demonstrations of fresh seafood favorites, available at all Harmon's locations.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the actor Judi Dench. She has a new book, a unique book. It's a series of conversations with her friend Brendan O'Hay talking about all the parts in Shakespeare she's played over the years. She talks about what she's learned about her craft, but also what Shakespeare has taught her about human emotion. Now, we didn't get Dame Judi for the conversation, though we did try, but Brendan O'Hay was available and more than happy to dish about his friend and the interviews they had over 4 years about Shakespeare, or as Judi calls him, the man who pays the rent. Let me tell you a few things I learned from just the Hamlet section alone, just quickly. Whatever you do, don't play the ending.
Yeah.
Which was great. Like, don't telegraph to the audience what's coming.
Yeah.
And then this, acting is learning how to edit.
Yes. Yeah. There we are. Well, Michelangelo, didn't he say something similar, you know, that David exists yeah. within the marble, that Carrara marble, you know? You don't kind of go, you just got to know what to chip away. It's already exists within there, you know, and editing is the essential art. You know, I think that's what links all art. It's what you choose to take away and what you choose to keep. And all too often, you know, she says, again, referencing Hamlet, when she started off, Ophelia, she threw everything at the mad scene when she's playing Ophelia. And now she mm-hmm. just kind of choose to play it. Now she would just have come on and do one moment where she would do something that wasn't quite right, whether it meant going up to Queen Gertrude and, going up to somebody who wasn't Gertrude and saying, I can't remember the line, but how doth the noble majesty of Denmark, but you walk to a servant or somebody, a chap or someone. And Jude said, that would be the moment you go, oh my God, she's not quite well, you know, this girl. You don't have to do a lot of rolling around and, you know, dribbling and flailing. You know, you just find that one thing that can tell that story. Because the audience are incredibly sophisticated. They will pick up on that.
You ask in one section, I think it was the Macbeth chapter, you ask whether the director Trevor Nunn ever talked about the rhythm and the structure of the verse. And she mentions that he didn't, but how John Barton, these are other directors for those in the audience, and Peter Hall, she says, they did. She says Peter Hall used to stand on a lectern and beat out the rhythm, the iambic pentameter, as they spoke the lines. And I just wanted to ask you about her regard for the rhythm of the verse, and learning, as she did from these early directors that she worked with, that what was it? The framework, I think, or the skeletal structure.
Yes.
Before you could move on to the other part of the language, of the words.
Well, that's right. I mean, and you think of blank verse. That does give you the structure, the scaffolding. Yeah, it's like a trellis, you know, where you grow plants up, you trail plants up. Well, that gives you the structure. And then those flowers can go whichever direction they want, and they can bloom wherever they want. But it just gives you the support. Prose is much harder. Shakespeare's prose, because we don't have those, we don't have the scaffolding in the same way. And I took from the book, I was teaching a group of students the other day, and I was talking about observing the line endings. This young student, an American lad, he said, "Ah, yeah, but that doesn't make any sense to me." He said, "You know, for instance, you know, Hamlet says, 'To be or not to be, that is the question.' That's the end of the iambic line. And then he says, 'Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer,' end of line, 'the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.'" And he says, of course, you'd have to go, "Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune." I said, yeah, but who could possibly come up with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? So what Jude would have said, I drew on her teaching of me and what I've learned from her. She would say, "To be or not to be, that is the question," end of the line. And then she would say, "Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune." And then suddenly, to suffer, you can have like bounce off the end of that line. and you're searching for that next thought, and you go, and you arrive at the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And then you hear Hamlet coining that phrase. You hear him inventing the words, inventing it. And then that's what makes it feel alive. But I learned that from Jude about kind of observing the line endings. So, yeah, she's taught me a lot about it. But structure, as I say, it holds it. It contains us. It gives us context. I think that is really, really important. Not everybody agrees with it, but, you know, for me, and certainly for her, it means a lot.
I wanted to highlight a few moments that I've found remarkable in the exchange that you had. These were things that you were noticing as Judi Dench is talking about these particular roles. For example, in the section about playing Cleopatra, you say to her that she changed physically when she was talking about these different parts.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment in Macbeth, playing Lady Macbeth, where she talks about being estranged. Lady Macbeth is become estranged from her husband. And he's in his own room alone when they used to be together. And he closes the door on her and he shuts her out. And she says, it's why she goes mad.
Yes.
That's why she actually dies, is because of that separation. And she goes someplace, and when she's talking to you, and you can almost sense, Brendan, that there's this pause here, and you say, you're back there in your mind, aren't you? I can see.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that?
Well, yeah, there was a few moments. I mean, Cleopatra, she became very kind of imperious and became kind of loose, and her arm would be kind of draped over the sofa, and then Lady Macbeth, I was looking at her hands, and they became like talons, like claws, and this kind of, it was like being trapped in a room with a cat. I mean, it was very peculiar, just talking about the words and then her saying some of the words. It was like I was kind of seeing these characters kind of evolve in front of me. It was very, very odd. She can just go there. She can go there. And similarly, you know, I know we mentioned it about Comedy of Errors, that took a while to come back. We had a few goes at that chapter. And then I showed her the film that was made of it, where her husband Michael was in, and the late, great Roger Rees. I mean, lots of lovely, wonderful actors. And she just said, well, you know, where have they gone? They look so vital. They look so full of life. Just where have they gone? And again, she went back somewhere else then. She could just go there in her imagination. I mean, you've seen those performances. You know, you see those extraordinary performances as Queen Victoria and Mrs. Brown and Victoria and Abdul. She can just turn on a sixpence and take you somewhere. You kind of, you know, shake hands with the devil, and you shake hands with darkness, because she can go there. She can access it. She can access those emotions incredibly well. But those, you know, those characters, those we mentioned, Cleopatra and Lady M, my God, they are within her. They are very, very near the surface. She can go there.
In the Measure for Measure part of the book, she talks about that ending. You know, it's ambiguous.
Yes.
It's messy, she says, which she says makes it very human. And she, again, read from the book. She says, I think it's lovely for the audience to be left with a question in their mind.
Yes.
Thinking about the play's morality. And then she says she likes the idea of an audience, you know, going out for a drink or something, or dinner, something to chew over later. So she likes the fact that people, it hasn't been tied up with a bow, and people are still working it out later.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and isn't that true of Shakespeare? You know, he doesn't answer any questions in his play. All he does, he poses more questions, and especially in that play. I mean, we had a bit of a punch up over that one, because I thought she was being far too romantic, because initially I think she said, until I provoked her, she said, oh, they'll just, you know, the Duke and Isabella will have a nice time together, and they'll have a nice marriage. You know, well, what happened to the kind of nun she wanted to be and all of that? Anyway, eventually we got to that point where she said, no, of course it's going to be you have to leave it open. That's why it's considered one of the problem plays, is because there's that extraordinary ambiguous ending. But yeah, she doesn't want the audience to go home and think, right, now, darling, where do we eat? She wants them to be provoked by it. And And that when Shakespeare works best, that is, you know, when the director hasn't served up, I think, you know, a specific ending and says, this is what it's about. You want to be talking about it afterwards. So isn't that why these plays have survived?
You ask if she thinks of herself as a purist about Shakespeare having to be set in, you know, the period when it was written. And she says she's not at all a purist. And then it did make me wonder, you don't talk about this in the book, but does she have any patience with the debate anyway about whether or not the person William Shakespeare actually wrote Shakespeare's plays? Does she have a thought about that? Does she entertain that, you know, that sort of modern debate?
She has a very strong thought about it, which is it was the person from Stratford. It's like, you know, why waste your time thinking of other things? I mean, it doesn't really bother me either. It just kind of, you just think the plays are so extraordinary. But there is a place for that. For me, I'm not particularly interested in it. And she certainly isn't. She doesn't kind of doubt it. Maybe she's over-romantic, and there's some things I disagree. You know, she has this lovely notion that Shakespeare in Charlecote Park in Stratford kind of stole the deer, but that's an apocryphal story. But she likes that, and I probably wouldn't go that far. But that's because she lived in Charlecote, and her husband Michael is buried now in the church in Charlecote. So maybe she's a bit romantic about Shakespeare. Well, I'm not to that extent, but yeah, she definitely thinks it's the man from Stratford. But each to their own, eh?
I love the part about King Lear, the way she talks about a play as being an overall design, and that it's like a jigsaw. Every part is a jigsaw piece in it, and then so if you are an actor who, as she says, elongates or stretches the character so far, it gets pulled out of shape.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit an overall design.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to – I'm not sure there's a question there, but I really liked this sort of insight about acting.
I had never seen it as that. And I met somebody the other day who said to me that her daughter went to an audition. I think it was for a TV role or something. But she'd read the book, our book, and that line stood out for her because she was so nervous about this audition. And then she thought, no, what is my function here? I'm just part of a jigsaw. So what is my character's function in these scenes? And that, for her, completely liberated her. She went in and she kind of shut everything else out. And then she told me, Mum called up a couple of days later and said, she got that job. Now, listen, she may have got that job anyway without reading that. But I thought that was a really interesting... You're absolutely right, Doug, to pick up on that. I thought that was a really interesting take, just to see your function. And you're just a little cog in something much bigger, and it just takes the pressure off you, thinking you've got to act the whole play. I totally agree. I think that's a really inspired point.
That's the actor and director Brendan O'Hay, along with Judy Dench. He's co-author of the book Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Judy Dench and her relationship with William Shakespeare. She has a new book, a series of conversations with her friend Brendan O'Hay about all the Shakespeare parts she's played over the years. The book is called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. There's this point in the conversation where you mentioned to her this experiment that was carried out in Liverpool in 2006. And these researchers wanted to find out how Shakespeare's words would, you know, what impact would they have on the brain? And so they scanned the brains of these people while they had, you know, listened to Shakespeare. And they used, in one particular experiment, they used a word from King Lear, the word madded.
Yeah.
M-A-D-D-E-D, madded. And scans showed madded fired off a lot of electrical activity in the brain. Yeah. But then when they changed MATTED to something more familiar, like something we would understand today as, you know, enraged, there was very little brain activity.
Yeah.
And she was delighted by this experiment. What do you understand about that? And what does that tell us about Shakespeare's language?
Well, you know, he made up so many words, and he turned nouns into verbs, and it just fizzes. And I know that was a discussion about, I think that's in the Lear chapter, isn't it? It's where we talk about changing words, and I think we simplify Shakespeare at our cost, because there's something about the rhythm and the unfamiliarity, and you're actually, I love that. I discovered that it was an article in the Guardian newspaper about Liverpool University, so that's why I put it in the book and provoked her with that. I think that is such an interesting story, that, because the danger with Shakespeare, if we try to even it out, and it's like playing a character, you think, well, I've got to be, you know, these characters are either all good or they're all bad. Well, it's not a fable. You know, there's that extraordinary line in All's Well That Ends Well, which one of the, it's a terribly boring character called one of the Domain brothers, but one of them says, "The web of our life is of a mingled yarn, good and ill together." And I love that, because that shows the complexity of these characters. I mean, you look at what happens with Henry V, you know, he goes against the Geneva Convention when he says, let's kill all the prisoners, and they kill a lot of the French prisoners. What's extraordinary about that, this kind of heroic figure called Henry V is suddenly, you know, he has darker forces working in him, and we don't like him at that point. If we try to make Shakespeare too smooth, or we throw out those fizzy, odd words, it loses its jaggedness, and I think its kind of capacity to make us kind of jolt. And as you rightly said, you know, it stops the synapses, you know, kind of firing in the brain in the same way. You know, a noble and a gracious father, him have you madded, is much better than what madded, you know, what? Instead of him, have you enraged? It doesn't have the same pull. It doesn't hit. And we know that from the, as you said, all these subjects being wired up, and that just the synapse is not firing in a similar way. So we even out Shakespeare at our cost, or even worse still, try to make it accessible. It is accessible. Do you know, I've got an actor in this company. He's in his early 30s. They've got two young kids. The four-year-old loves Shakespeare. She can quote whole, this is a four-year-old, she could quote To Be or Not to Be, I think, which is about 3 years old. She's learning one of Rosalind's speeches at the moment. And he came in today and he showed me this four-year-old. I said, I've got to send this to Jude. She's having a tea. I think she's got a bowl of kind of cereal or something in front of her, spaghetti. And she's listening. I think it's an audio thing and not a visual thing. She's listening to Jude doing a bit of Twelfth Night, where she says, my father had a daughter, loved a man. And this child is absolutely transfixed with a load of kind of spaghetti or something on a spoon. And you think, these words from this dead white writer from 400 years ago, it is connecting with that child who hasn't yet kind of formed a kind of language and developed a full intellect. You know, this is a four-year-old. There is something in the rhythm. And I haven't even told you that yet. I mean, she'll be absolutely thrilled. Not that the kid, you know, that loves Jude speaking the words, but the fact that the words are having a chemical effect on this child. She just loves it, this child. So that I can't tell you how happy that makes me feel.
You mentioned in the book something you once read about Shakespeare, how, you know, trying to work out Shakespeare's personality was kind of like looking at a very dark, kind of clouded picture in a portrait gallery, but eventually it becomes more and more clear, and then you realize, as you write, those features are your own.
Yeah.
Say more about that, will you?
Well, I cannot remember where I read that quote from. It's a quote from a book, and it's about, you know, people who are saying, who are these characters, or who is Shakespeare? And it's like looking at a portrait of Shakespeare in the National Portrait Gallery. And at first you don't see anything. It's very, very, very dark. And then you see a few outlines, and then you see a face, and then you realize it's your own face. You see your own reflection in these parts. And that's why I know we talk about it in the book, about Jude was being full of empathy for Polonius in Hamlet. And I said, does it take being a parent to understand Polonius's difficulties? And she said, well, yeah, because, you know, you grow with these parts and you know, they evolve and they reflect different parts of your life back to you. You understand them in a different way, or maybe you dismiss them in a different way because they're ever changing, because they tell us who we are. I mean, something she says in every single interview is just, you know, whatever emotion you felt, whether it's envy or love or greed or jealousy, you just go back to the place. And it's there. You know, when we were all despairing during COVID, as Jude said, she couldn't stop thinking about, I wasted time and now doth time waste me, which is a quote from Richard II. It's just, he's kind of answered all the questions, really. He's just answered. And he has, as Jude says in the book, you know, his words and his thoughts, what he has to say, makes us feel less alone, because he's able to articulate what we are feeling at any given point.
You asked her if she thinks Shakespeare has a future. What did she tell you?
Well, she kind of despaired a bit, and she worried about it because she didn't think. She worried about dumbing down or making it too over accessible. Although I think that certainly has a place, making it accessible. What I said to her was, and I do a lot of teaching, which I'm passionate about, and I'm particularly passionate about international students. A lot of Americans. I was in the Hollywood Bowl about, I think it was the last acting job I did, about 2017, 2018. And I played Ina Barbas with the LA Philharmonic. We did a kind of an hour and a half version of Antony Cleopatra. And afterwards, I met a youngster, a young girl who couldn't have been older than about 11. And again, another one who kind of quoted whole kind of tracts of Shakespeare back at me. And I thought, oh God, you know, I just wanted all these adults who criticize kids and just say they don't know anything or they have no interest. They're always on their iPhones. I wanted to kind of say that, come and see this girl here. Or this 4-year-old I've just talked about. Or come to some of my classes at the Globe, or where I teach in the drama schools here with the international students, where you've got a room of Americans with Russians and Chinese students and from all over the world, and they're united by these extraordinary words. And I just think, you know, and listen to these kids. And you know, hearing Shakespeare in American, all the Americans all too often, they want to kind of even it out and make it, you know, make it sound British. Not always, but you've got, you know, we know for a fact through the way the rhymes are constructed in Shakespeare, that it sounded more American than it certainly did a kind of an RP British. Mm. These are your words. But similarly, I love hearing it in Norwegian or in Italian. They're all our words. And you see these kids kind of connect with this material. You go, we can't despair about the future. Through this language, he builds bridges. I remember a couple of years ago, I was touring a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and we were in China. And I was playing Peter Quince, and a friend of mine was playing Bottom in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And he did the speech about Bottom's dream. And I was just looking at the audience through the side of the stage. And there was a little tiny Chinese 4-year-old girl sitting in the front row, and her legs didn't kind of, you know, of course didn't touch the floor. She was tiny, tiny, tiny kid. And she was just laughing at the rhythm of Shakespeare's work. She was utterly delighted by this guy playing Bottom and Bottom's dream when he wakes up. And I just thought, where else do I want to be here now? You know, in this other country, in front of another culture, and there we are. There's this again, this dead white writer from 400 years ago connecting through a British actor with this Chinese kid. You know, and you just think, oh God, you know. And I hope to God we continue. There's a whole debate in this country at the moment. You know, we're not encouraging youngsters to play with it in school. See, this is my question to you. Why does it take an American like Sam Wanamaker to come over to the UK? Why does it take an American to say, where is there the Globe Theatre? And there's just a plaque on the wall. Why does it take then this American to fight to build the Globe Theatre? Sadly, he died before it was realised. But I don't think we appreciate the culture in this country. You know, we have to kind of go abroad. I have to be around Americans or God knows, you know, any other kind of students from across the world to make us appreciate how extraordinary this language, you know, we have. And I want these American students or these, you know, Chinese or you know, Norwegian or Italian kids, to just go, just say the words, make these kids here, you know, appreciate what we have on our doorstep. But I believe in answer to your question, which you asked ages ago, but in answer to your question, that there is definitely a future, because I've seen it in the eyes of too many kids. I've seen it in the passion of too many students. I see their love for it. When I hear about youngsters passionate about these words, I go, there is hope. Because in these words, we can communicate, we can make the world a better place.
Brendan O'Hay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brendan O'Hay, along with Judy Dench, he's co-author of the book Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube also at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you with comments or suggestions. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.